Welcome to the TM Podcast. Today's podcast features Bob Roth, the CEO of the David Lynch Foundation and the author of the best-selling book, Strength in Stillness. Bob is joined on stage by David Lynch, the award-winning filmmaker. This talk was recorded on February 13, 2018 at the Norse Theater in San Francisco before an audience of 1,600.
Good evening. Thank you. Welcome to City Arts and Lectures. I'm your interlocutor tonight, still unemployed Mythbuster Adam Savage. You're in for a treat tonight. You get a twofer. And we're doing this in a slightly interesting way because there's only one chair out here. I'm going to interview our two guests tonight separately. These are two different men from different backgrounds with a singular and conjoined mission, which is to bring the stillness and peace they have found through their meditation practice to the world. And so first up, please welcome me in giving a warm round of applause to our first guest. He is one of the most sought after and experienced practitioners and teachers of transcendental meditation. He has been practicing for 45 years, and he is author of the new book, Strength in Stillness. Please welcome to the stage, Bob Roth. Cheers. Good evening, sir.
Wonderful to be here. Back home, San Francisco.
So you're from San Francisco. You're from the Bay Area.
Born in D.C. when I was 3 years old. My dad got a job at Fort Miley VA Hospital in 1953. And then I moved across to Marin County to Greenbrae before anybody had even knew what Greenbrae was. There were no roads. And grew up there and then went to Berkeley.
So
yeah.
A local boy. Let's start with the biggest question. What is transcendental about transcendental meditation?
Good question. First of all, I can't see anybody, but how many people here do some form of meditation? Yeah. So I'm going to put this in context. So the word transcendental, if you look up Webster's dictionary, it says to transcend is to go beyond ordinary human limitations. So we seek to transcend often when we feel stale or bored or stuck. So we go to a new vacation place for a vacation, or we take a spin class, or we try a new restaurant, or we join a reading club. We do something to sort of break out of the ordinary to the extraordinary. And the problem is the extraordinary relatively quickly can become ordinary. So we're constantly looking for something different to break boundaries. And the thing is when you're just looking for transcendence on the horizontal level, it's limited. So in transcendental meditation, to transcend means just to settle down to these deeper, more powerful levels of your own self and to experience the quietest, deepest level of your own self, which the ancients called the source of thought, and which today the modern scientists have come up with a very poetic term called the state of restful alertness. So it's not a very exciting thing. But if I could take a moment, when I talk about meditation, I like to use the analogy of an ocean. So you're on a little boat, and you in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and you get these giant 30, 40-foot high waves. And you could rightfully think the whole ocean is an upheaval, 40 feet waves, huge. But if you could do a cross-section of the ocean out there, what you'd realize is you got these little itty-bitty 30-foot waves, but in reality, the ocean is a mile deeper. And while the nature of the ocean is turbulent on the surface, by its nature, the ocean is relatively calm and silent at its depth. So I use that as an analogy to the mind. The surface of the mind is the surface, and some people call it the monkey mind. We like to call it the gotta mind. I gotta do this, and I gotta do that, and I gotta call him, and I gotta call her, and I gotta make a list, and I gotta find a list.
I have discovered that the best way to figure out what I have to do today is to try and meditate.
Yeah, that's right. Big, long list. Exactly right. And the thing is, that gotta mind, every human being has a natural desire, I'd like to have some inner calm, some inner clarity, some inner ease, some inner focus, or in the case of creatives, some inner inspiration, some inner access, and the operative word is inner. And the question is there such a thing as an inner? And if so, how do we get there? So when we talk about transcendental meditation, we hypothesize, because there's no belief system, that deep within every human being, right now, everyone here, everyone, there's a level of the mind that is already calm and settled and wide awake. That's the hypothesis, but we've lost access to it. And so the purpose of meditation throughout time has been to bring equanimity to the mind. And keep going, all right?
No, yeah, please.
Okay.
Yeah,
keep going. So I love the science. I'm going to move into the science. I love the science. So the thing is that according to research now, really doing research on the brain, there's three basic types of meditation, legitimate types of meditation. One is called focused attention, and many people here, Vipassana is part of that,
right,
that tradition. That's a concentration form of meditation. It's a control of the mind. And when you, it's like trying to stop the waves on the surface of the ocean. I mean, this is simplistic, but, and when you do that, the brain, you create what's called gamma brain waves, which are 20 to 50 cycles per second, usually in the frontal lobe on the left front for compassion and that part. So, and that's hard work. Second type of meditation is called open monitoring, and that's many mindfulness techniques, and that's an observational tool. You're watching the waves rise and fall, and you're not getting too upset. You're in the present. You're sort of emotionally, you're sort of disengaging.
The watching, the watcher.
The watching, the watcher, yes. And it's not, it's like, the thought isn't the problem. The content of the thought can be there. So if you don't know a guy named Joe, and the thought of Joe comes up, eh. But if Joe done you wrong 2 days ago or 20 years ago, and Joe comes up, so what we learn is how to disengage, witness, watch the watcher. When we do that, it creates something called theta brain waves, which are 6 to 8 cycles per second. That is a sort of onset dream. It's the mind thinking, quietly thinking. Also, there's alpha 2, which back of the brain, occipital lobe, when you close your eyes. It's a wonderful coping tool. And the third is called self-transcending, and that's transcendental meditation. And in that, again, we don't, it's not a cognitive process. I'm not trying to control my thoughts. No can do for many of us. And what we do is we just allow the thinking mind, the heated thinking mind, to just settle down and access these deeper, quieter, calmer levels. And when that happens, the brain, completely different brainwave signature. Anybody awake? Brainwave signature. Alpha 1, which is a state of deep inner quiet and reflective, and the body gains a state of rest in many regards deeper than sleep, which doesn't show up. And so you have a reduction in cortisol by 40%, a whole constellation of changes. Long answer to a short question.
So how did you come to transcendental meditation? Tell me the origin story.
So I grew up in the very political family in the 1950s and 1960s in San Francisco, and then my family, we talk politics all the time, and it was, you know, I was born in 1950, so I like to tell people growing up, and some of you can relate to this, that I knew I was a Democrat before I knew I was Jewish. So, yeah, a lot of...
Yeah. I'm a Democrat from New York, so I'm an honorary Jew.
No, not honorary, you're yeah. Full-blooded.
Exactly.
It's like, you're on, you're in. And I worked, you know, 50 years ago right now, I was the editor of my high school newspaper in Redwood High School newspaper, and I had a column, this will tell you how politically active I was, the column was entitled, The Gripes of Roth. Vintage, 1968. Vintage. And, you know, I'm whining about, but... and by the way, in February 1968 is also when the Beatles went and studied, spent a month with Maharishi in India, which I wasn't really aware of. I worked for Bobby Kennedy. I wanted to change the world, Bobby Kennedy. As a matter of fact, June 1st, 1968, I was in San Francisco at the San Francisco Convention Center to watch Bobby Kennedy. I heard Bobby Darin, I remember it, Bobby Darin sang and Bobby Kennedy spoke, and I thought, I am part of something here. I wasn't interested in like politics as much as just the cause. I wanted to make a better world. And 4 days later, he was assassinated. And it was a destruction of a 17-year-old kid's. So I went to Berkeley with the intention of going to law school to become a U.S. senator like Bobby Kennedy. I wanted to change the world. And very quickly in 1968, I know it's a long answer, but very quickly in 1968, politics wasn't for me. So I got into education, and because my mother was an educator, I thought, all right, educational curriculum. And a friend said, you should learn transcendental meditation. You're stressed out of your mind. I said, I have enough problems with my own religion. And he said, it's not something you have to believe in. Try it. I learned it. I liked it so much. One of my first thoughts afterwards was, I'd like to teach this to inner city school kids. Next answer will be much shorter.
But you, you've been teaching, I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
You've been teaching for 45 years. You must have witnessed some really startling transformations in your students. I'm curious if any specific ones come to mind.
Well, for me, the I taught many people, but the things that my goal, my mission, the David Lynch Foundation, is to teach the meditation to underserved either kids, veterans, women who are survivors of domestic violence, preventing the opioid addiction. I really want to bring that.
You're describing all of these groups are groups that experience
trauma,
large mental trauma.
And they're largely forgotten, or they're marginalized, and we don't really pay any attention to it. And I will tell you a story. This is quite moving to me. In New York City, there's a program for homeless men where they spend a year in vocational training. It's called the Doe Fund. And they take men off the streets, and then they make a commitment for a year. So a friend of mine, Mario Orsatti, taught this guy, Joseph, who was a tall man, missing most of his teeth, leathered skin. And Mario told me, he said, you got to meet Joseph. So I went up and talked to him. Joseph had a master's in philosophy from Yale. He had a job in the Twin Towers. 15 minutes before the plane hit, he walked out on an errand, and all of his people that he worked with were killed. Now, Joseph, when he was at Yale, had a little issue with drinking, and he started drinking so much that he got a little violent. His wife and children left. He lost his job. He lost his house, and within 6 months, Joseph was homeless. So 2 years, he's on the streets. Then we bring TM to this. And he said, it changed his life, the calm. And he said, isn't it interesting that there's the word is a shloka or a sutra, the aphorism that I love the most, which is the basic unity of life. He said, I am that, unboundedness, thou art that, unity, all of this is nothing but that. And he said, isn't it interesting, something that I learned in college, it took me ending up in a homeless shelter to have the experience of that reality for my life. So that's a big answer. Most people, they feel they sleep better and they, you know, they're happier. But I tell you, this is San Francisco, I can tell big stories.
You remind me of that Ram Dass says, one of my favorite quotes of his is, only total despair can precede a change in consciousness.
Yeah. There's a ton of research that shows that PTS, when we teach, the Department of Defense gave a $2.5 million grant to study the effects of transcendental meditation on post-9/11 veterans, a study that was done in San Diego on 200 of them, and it showed a significant reduction in PTSD among the meditating veterans, more so than the other interventions.
I'm curious about the science. I'm curious, you've been doing research on this, and there's been studies being done on TM for decades. Can you talk to me about some of
the first research that came out was done at Harvard Medical School and UCLA. It was conducted in 1968 and published in 1970 in Science Magazine, in 1972 in Scientific American, and it showed a significant reduction in blood pressure and a waking up of the electrical activity of the brain such that they proposed at the time this could be a fourth major state of consciousness. The meditative state could be a fourth state of consciousness different from waking, dreaming, and sleeping, and not an altered state brought on by hypnosis or drugs. Since that time, there have been now 400 studies published in peer-reviewed journals. National Institutes of Health have given almost $30 million to study its effects on heart disease and high blood pressure. I said the Department of Defense. One of the reduction in depression and anxiety, we're about to start a study funded by Michael J. Fox on the effects of TM on Parkinson's, because anxiety really fuels and exacerbates that. There was a study that just came out, published a peer-reviewed journal on preventing relapse for people who have alcohol use disorder. People can go away on something for a month, stop drinking, and then they quickly relapse. And so what they found was, compared to controls, there was a 50% reduction in relapse. So a lot of research, and the David Lynch Foundation is helping to push that.
I'm curious also if you've done fMRI studies or looking at actually what's happening in the brain during...
I think one of the most exciting areas of research right now is on the brain and creativity. So there's three different... They used to think that, the right hemisphere is their region. That's your creative. So they thought, you know, that the region of the right hemisphere is creativity. The left hemisphere, that's the artist, the scientist, or the connection. It's not that. It's networks. So now they understand it. It's connections within the brain. So we all know we have a prefrontal cortex, which when you meditate lights up on the brain scan. And that's your executive functioning. That's decision-making, judgment, planning. That's the attention, task-positive work. There's another part of the brain they're just discovering, doing the research, called the default mode network. It's kind of a boring name. They also call it, to make it more interesting, the imagination network. And it connects the part of your brain when you're not task-oriented, when you're not trying to figure out a math problem, when you're just sitting, then your brain, the defaults to this activity. And that's your sort of mulling the past, the future, and that's where you get your great ideas. When you take a hot shower, great ideas. When you go for a walk, great ideas. So they're sort of opposites. Here's my focus, and here's my wandering mind. And creative thinkers have them both simultaneously. It's not that there's a part of the, you know, that shuts down the wandering mind, and that's a David Lynch. That's a you, the work you do. It's both. And so the research I find very exciting. I mean, there's research that shows it grows, you know, gray matter. That's old. The new stuff is, I think, these networks and connections. And so what it shows is meditation in general has an effect on the brain. But I think what's most interesting is when they're really, I don't like to say drilling down with the brain, but drilling down and sort of seeing what's going on. And I want to conclude by saying, when I'm up here and when David is here, I'm not passing judgment. I'm not saying this meditation is better than that meditation. It's outcomes. Push-ups are different than sit-ups. Vitamin C is different than vitamin D. We don't need to silo. But what we do need to do is understand fully these different approaches and see how they work individually and how they can work collectively. So tonight, and particularly with David, he's going to come and talk about some amazing stories of transcendental meditation. It's great. So this is something you get to hear about tonight, and if it's something you want to incorporate in your life, great. If not, also fine.
I think that's a perfect segue. Thank you for bringing out the second guest. Please give Bob a hand. Thank you. And now, please welcome to the stage a man who needs no introduction, David Lynch.
Adam.
Well, good evening, sir.
Good evening. Good evening to you all.
Tell me how you first found transcendental meditation.
I heard first about transcendental meditation when the Beatles went with Maharishi, and I had zero interest in it. I thought it was a fad, and I thought it was a waste of time, and I just wanted to work. I said, it's fine for the Beatles, and I hope they keep making music. And then I heard a phrase, true happiness is not out there, true happiness lies within. And this phrase had a ring of truth to it, to me. But also, they don't tell you in the phrase where the within is, nor how to get there. So it's a really frustrating phrase. And then I heard this word enlightenment, and I wondered if a human being could, if there was such a thing. And then I thought, I think it's just an Eastern thing, maybe, and I'm in the West. And then I started thinking more, and I thought, wait a minute. Maybe this meditation is a way to go within and find that happiness. So it was like the stars turned or something. I got obsessed with, you know, finding this answer and I found that in the world, many, many forms of meditation, as Bobby was saying. And I read books, I talked to people, I asked so many questions, and I got nothing I found seemed right. And for me. And then one day my sister called, and she said she started transcendental meditation. I asked her all these questions about it. I liked what she was telling me. But most importantly, I heard a change in her voice. More happiness, more self-assuredness. And I said, I want this thing, and I went and got it.
I'm reminded that when Kurt Vonnegut's wife and daughter discovered TM, he said, nothing pisses them off. They're like bass drums with a light bulb inside.
We are like light bulbs, human beings. And we broadcast out what's inside. And, you know, if a person is filled with anger, they broadcast that out. And I say this anger is like a poison to them. And they broadcast this poison out, and no one likes to be around them. But if you're filled with bliss, happiness, you broadcast that out, and people feel good being around.
Talk to me about the before and the after. Is there a difference you can remember between you before you were doing TM and afterwards?
Yes. You could say meditation isn't really good for marriage, because I've been married 4 times. But
That's just 4 anecdotes.
I had a big anger for my situation, and I took it out on my first wife, Peggy. I made her life miserable, especially in the morning. And I started transcendental meditation. 2 weeks later, she comes to me, and she says, what's going on? And I was, as they say, quiet for a moment, because it could have been any number of things. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, this anger, where did it go? And I didn't even realize it. The thing is, things start changing, but it seems natural, each change. And so your friends or other people notice things more than you do. And this anger is lifted away. I started treating her, you know, much better. And I got happier inside. And I got more self-assured. And in the film business, before I was creative, maybe, but I wasn't so self-assured, and I could have been steamrolled by the business. Mm-hmm. And I believe that it's this happiness when transcendental meditation is a mental technique. Ancient form of meditation brought back for this time by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. In transcendental meditation, you're given a mantra. A mantra is a very specific sound, vibration, thought. And it's like a law of nature designed for a specific purpose. And the purpose of the mantra is to turn the attention, the awareness, from out, 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 180 degrees to within, within, within. Once you're pointed within, you will naturally and easily dive through deeper levels of mind and intellect. The reason it's easy and effortless, each deeper level of mind and intellect has more, as they say, charm, more happiness. The border of intellect, you transcend. and you experience the big treasury, the ocean of pure consciousness. And this consciousness has qualities. So within every one of us human beings is unbounded intelligence, creativity, happiness known as bliss, love, universal love, which feeds personal love, energy, power, and peace, an unbounded amount. Every time a human being truly transcends and experiences this ocean, they infuse some of that. So they really and truly start expanding whatever consciousness they had to begin with and all those positive qualities. The side effect of that is negativity starts to lift away without trying. Like when in a dark room, you have a light on a dimmer, you dim it up, automatically darkness goes. Stress, traumatic stress, anxiety, tension, sorrow, depression, hate, bitter anger, need for revenge, and fear automatically start to lift. And I call it the suffocating rubber clown suit of negativity. And it's suffocating a heavy rubber, rotted kind of heavy rubber. And when it starts dissolving, it feels so good. I say it's like gold coming in from within, garbage going out. And it happens for every human being. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. It serves the work and serves the life. And when you transcend, they call it a holistic experience. So all avenues of life start improving, just automatically.
Were you already making films by the time in 73 when you first discovered it?
I had made three short films, and I was right in the middle of working on my first feature film, Eraserhead. And that's when I started.
Did you notice a difference in how TM affected your creative process?
Yes. I say negativity is the enemy of creativity. They say if you're so depressed, you can't even get out of bed, let alone go to work or enjoy working. Negativity, in my mind, is it squeezes the tube through which the ideas flow. It just cramps everything. Anger, it occupies the mind, and you can't think those ideas. So you get that tube opening up, and expanding consciousness, the ball of consciousness getting bigger, you can catch ideas on a deeper level. The ideas seem to flow more freely. You wouldn't get more, like, writer's block so easily. The ideas seem to come. And you get this happiness in the doing. And you get more energy to do the work. And you get this love, and the relationships seem to improve. People look better. And you don't want to kill people. It's really beautiful. And so it's a good thing all the way around.
I remember being in my late teens in New York and noticing that depending on my mood, sometimes everyone on the subway looked like a king or a queen or a prince, and sometimes everyone looked like just the worst villain.
Exactly right. This is more like the king and the queen and the prince. But not that you can't relate to them. You want to go sit with them and put your arm around them. And they take you to the palace.
Your films are famous in part for having a certain type of inscrutability to them, some mysterious aspects that don't seem to get resolved narratively. I'm curious if that is informed by your experience with TM.
I don't know. I think, in one way, maybe the whole setup is very simple, and it also is super complicated. And what I like is just catching ideas, and when you're lucky, you catch ideas that you fall in love with. And you know that feeling. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful day when you catch an idea that you love. And when you're in love, then you know what you're going to do. When you catch an idea, you see it, and you hear it, and you feel it, you see the mood, you see or a person, and then you go and you do those things. And people sometimes say, do you get ideas from dreams? I say, I don't, but I love dream logic. I love this kind of thing that words can't quite describe, but cinema can say. And that's language of cinema can say these things that are difficult to put back into words. And that's the kind of ideas that I seem to fall in love with.
You said in Catching the Big Fish that cinema is an art form that can hold abstractions.
Yeah, it can hold concrete things and abstract things in the same story.
And do your films, I mean, someone might see one of your films and wonder, what was that about? And they're going to ask you, it strikes me that your response might be, I don't know. Your guess is
no,
as good as mine.
No, I have to know for myself.
You always know.
Yes. Sometimes I don't know right away, but I think about the things, and I come up with an answer for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And but people, you know, if I always say, the frames of the film may be, they are exactly the same each screening, but the audience is different. It's incredible. Every person in the audience is different, and they get different things from the same film.
Do your films change for you over the years? Does your work?
No. They were perfect when I finished, and they stayed perfect.
You say ideas are like fish. What do you mean?
I mean that a lot of catching ideas is like fishing, in my mind. A desire is like a bait on a hook. Just desiring ideas, it must set something up. And I like to daydream. And you desire an idea, it's like putting bait on a hook and lowering it in. And catching fish is like catching ideas. They're out there, and they'll swim in, and you'll catch them. A lot of them don't mean anything. You don't love them. But then once in a while, you'll catch one that you love. You'll catch one that you really love. It just may be a fragment of the whole that's going to come, but you love it so much. And just because of this love, you focus on it, and it becomes more of a bait. You lower that little fish in, and they'll more will swim in. And like you catch a kind of a school of fish that eventually will form a script, or a chair, or a painting, or whatever.
You started the David Lynch Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
What is your goal? What is the reason?
I went to Fairfield, Iowa, one time. And while I was there, I was invited to go to a high school play. And it was raining and cold. And I thought, a high school play, I got to go out in this weather. This is going to be a boring, tough night. And I went to this little theater, packed, sitting in a place where I couldn't get out even if I wanted to.
Nightmare.
Out on the stage came these students. All these students had been practicing transcendental meditation for years. They came, now they weren't actors, they were just students.
Mm-hmm.
They came out onto this stage. I was just completely blown away. I saw consciousness dancing on their faces. So much intelligence, timing, it was an emotion and humor, all these things, and it was just seemed like it was effortless to them, and they were super enjoying it, but doing it perfect. I thought it could go to Broadway. It was incredible. Mm. And I said, every actor should practice transcendental meditation. It gives you that it thing. It's a kind of an inner glow. It's a glow where you just can't stop watching. This is what I saw on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought every student should have this. And one thing led to another. It wasn't my idea to form this thing. They came to me and asked me if I wanted to. And I thought, I've heard of people having foundations. I didn't ever think anything about it. And so I just said, okay, thinking it was going to go nowhere. And now it's turned into something.
Why is
Thanks a lot to Bobby Roth. Bobby Roth is the director of the David Lynch Foundation, and he's put together an incredible team. And you've heard about all the research he's doing, and you know the people that you know are starting TM these days. It's the receptivity has gone so high, and people are enjoying their experiences so much, it seems like we're at or in the tipping point. It's very beautiful what's going on.
Why is it important to teach kids transcendental meditation?
Kids, okay, I'll tell you a story. And this town, San Francisco, and one of the worst schools in San Francisco, I think it was called Visitation Valley Middle School. The principal's name was Jim Dierke. This man is a hero in my book. Jim is not a New Age mumbo-jumbo, you know, kind of guy. A regular guy. And he was the principal of this school. This school had terrible grades, teacher burnout, fights in the school, fights bad enough, they almost once a week, that brought the police and an ambulance. It was a nightmare. The students were filled with torment. A lot of these students, I'm sure, were filled with post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. And Jim had tried all these different things. There are many well-wishers in the world, and they've come up with different things to help the schools. He tried these things that did not help. He was told about transcendental meditation, and he said, "You gotta be kidding me." And he was like, "You know, this is ridiculous." And they said, "Look into some of this research." And Jim did this. And lo and behold, one day he said, "Okay," not maybe so enthusiastically, but he said, "Let's give it a try." The TM teachers came in. They had a thing with the parents and teachers that the parents could say, they explained it, and the parents could say, "Yes, I want my child to have this," or "No, I do not want my child to have this." About maybe, say, 60% said yes. And the teachers the same. And they started teaching it. You learn one-on-one. It took a long time to teach, you know, the ones that wanted. Mm-hmm. A couple of months later, some of the parents and the students that didn't want it see the changes in the students, and they say, "Wait a minute, I changed my mind. I want to get this." Pretty soon, pretty much the whole school's meditating. The grades went up. Fighting stopped. Relationships among the students got way, way, way good. Relationships between the students and the teachers got good. Teachers started to enjoy teaching again. The teachers had a room to meditate in. Students meditated 15 minutes in the morning in the gymnasium when they got there, 15 minutes at the end of the day when they left. It affected their home life in a good way in the school. Mm. I visited the school. It was like blissful, a school you would want to go to.
A middle school.
A middle school. And it was this beautiful, beautiful thing. I would love to go to a middle school.
Every time I meet a middle school student, I say, "It gets better."
This got pretty good.
The film industry is famous for being a very stressful industry. And you just delved back into the world of Twin Peaks for the third time. How was that for you?
So much fun. It was unbelievably good. Really good. I got to see a lot of the old, you know, people, and young old people,
yeah.
and a lot of great new people. And it was a long haul, but fun all the way through.
It must be wonderful to see the people that you worked with, but also to work with those characters again.
Yes, exactly right. It was beautiful. And sad at the same time. Miguel Ferrer passed away. Harry Dean Stanton passed away. Catherine Coulson, the log lady, passed away. A man who played a role of Toad in the Double R Diner passed away. Dave Mackley, a detective in Buckhorn, passed away. So a lot of sadness and a lot of feeling very fortunate I got to work with them. And now I wish I could, you know, go back and, you know, work with those same people. But it was beautiful all the way.
The film is also famous for long days. You've been meditating, you said, 40 minutes a day, two 20-minute periods since 1973. I did the math. That's actually 1.4 years of meditation.
Fantastic.
How does the meditation fit into, let's say, a long shoot day for you?
I meditate in the morning before I leave, mm-hmm. And at lunch, I meditate my second meditation at lunch. Just, I've never missed a meditation in 44 years.
Never?
Never.
That's incredible.
My friend Charlie Lutz, who ran the center where I started,
yeah.
He said, David, the most important thing you can do for yourself is meditate regularly, transcend every day. And I took that to heart.
Aside from meditation, what advice would you give to a young artist starting out in their career?
I say, find your own voice. Always have Final Cut. Okay, well, you laugh, but not having Final Cut, I came to filmmaking through painting.
Yeah.
When you're painting a painting, no one comes in and says, change that, I don't like that, you know, or a committee looks at it and decides what they're going to change. You should be allowed to make your film. If they want you to make the film, they should support you and have them make the film that they hired you to make. It needs to be done with freedom and support, and every element has to feel correct before you walk away. It has to pass really through one person. You have a huge team, but if it passes through many people, it won't hold together. So find your own voice, have Final Cut, control over the work, and never take a bad idea, but never turn down a good idea. It's not to say you're closed to some suggestion, but you have the final say. And don't take no for an answer. And start transcendental meditation.
When you talk about fishing for ideas, do you have a practice where you go looking for them? Is there aside from transcendental meditation, an exercise, or do you sketch? Do you draw? Do you still paint?
I still paint, and like I said, I like to daydream, but you never know when an idea is going to come. Something you just catches on the corner of your eye, that thing pops in as an idea. Or daydreaming, you'll get an idea. Walking down the street, you'll get an idea. It's just the strangest thing. They're out there. They say you don't know something until it enters the conscious mind. And then you see that. That's why in the cartoons they make a light bulb. It goes off, you got an idea.
It's
very beautiful. I don't do anything particular, but the thing I do is I'm always desiring ideas, and I think that is like a magnet that kind of helps pull them in.
You're reminding me that I saw Arlo Guthrie in concert many years ago, and he said the same. He said that writing a song was like sitting by a river and waiting for a song to come by. And then he said that he didn't think that anyone downstream of Bob Dylan had ever even seen a song.
Okay, now another thing. You know, another thing that gets ideas going is to do something. Like if you have a blank sheet of paper, even if you don't even have anything to say, if you just start writing anything, that pen will start, you know, making sentences. So much of it is absolute worthless, but maybe one will be a golden sentence. And if you're doing on a drawing, if you just start working on it, it may not be the finished drawing, but it'll give you ideas for something else to start another drawing. It's by doing things, ideas start to, it's a flow of ideas come.
I'm curious, if you work linearly, or like on a single project, the ideas are coming for that single project, or do you bring in ideas that you write down and they'll come up years later in a different project?
All the time. Fragments of ideas. I've got boxes filled. I'm just starting to go through those boxes now to see if there's anything in there that's gold or it'll trigger something.
Yeah. I've noticed lately as I draw a lot. I'll label a drawing. This drawing is terrible. And then I'll go back
that's
later.
That's okay, because if you pass away and they find that drawing, at least they know you thought it stuck.
I notice that when I go back and look at it, I think, oh, I think you were a little
hard on
yourself.
You could burn the thing, too, you know.
We are living right now in a very stressful time. You sincerely believe that transcendental meditation can really help to bring about some healing or some resolution to what we're going through?
Absolutely. It's a thing. If you think about it, you know, within each of us human beings is this field, and it's us. It's the big self with a capital S.
The collective.
They say on the surface we're all different, and at the source we're one, the self with a capital S. And that line, know thyself, is that self. You don't look in the mirror and try to know yourself or analyze yourself. It's the big self. And this field is a field of infinite, unbounded peace. We just lost contact with it. And Maharishi brought out two things. Technologies to bring a full potential of the human being, enlightenment, and technologies to bring peace on Earth. Enlivening this field with a group practicing transcendental meditation and advanced techniques in a group, they say, is quadratically more powerful than the same number scattered about. Mm-hmm. And this group practicing these techniques together and can enliven this field of peace and affect collective consciousness to turn that dark cloud to gold, to make a happiness in the environment, to do the same thing to that collective consciousness that happens in the individual. Stress starts going out. All this negativity starts lifting, and the gold, all those positive qualities coming up in the people, whether they meditate or not. So you get, they say, a man goes to bed filled with anger and wakes up in the morning and wonders where it went. You get a situation, you can go anywhere in the world and meet a friend, not an enemy, where people start really enjoying life and with a bubble of happiness. They say, mankind was not meant to suffer. We're supposed to be like happy little dogs, I say, wiggling that tail.
Why do you think, this is a softball, why do you think stress is toxic to creativity?
I got this whole thing before I started meditating. I said, this meditation could make me very calm and not even want to work. I just want to sit up under a tree or maybe knit doilies. And I said, artists has got to have an edge. And you got to have, you know, maybe even an anger and all this kind of stuff. And the starving artist in the garret is this romantic thing. Mm-hmm. And I say, the starving artist who's cold in the garret is romantic for everyone except the starving artist. Negativity is the enemy to creativity. And when you start transcending every day and all this positive stuff comes up, it feeds the work. You get more of an edge. You get more energy than you had before. What's wrong with that? Common sense would tell you it's going to serve the work. You don't get goody-goody two-shoes. You still fall in love with certain ideas that thrill you. And you get more ideas. And you get, you're diving into infinite creativity within us human beings, the creativity that creates everything. And you get wet with that, stands to reason you get more creative. And all these things start building up. So you don't lose anything. But I know the feeling of fear that you'd, you know, I went to a psychiatrist once and I asked him before I sat down even, I said, do you think that talking, you're going through this could affect my creativity? And he said, well, David, I think it could. And I shook his hand and I left. So we're afraid of those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But my experience has been, serves the work, more of an edge, more of a thing. Righteous anger or anger for some, you know, being for something is just huge. You know, you get more of that. Mm-hmm. And so it's a beautiful for the life and the work.
Awesome. I think I'd like to pass the questions out to the audience. So if we could bring Bob back out and bring up the house lights, you guys can have your chance to ask these two amazing gentlemen your questions. Please welcome back to the stage Bob Roth.
Hi, Mulholland Drive is probably the best movie I've ever seen. My brother and I are kind of obsessed with it. And I guess it's something that we've thought about what the meaning was behind it. And I think we both think that there's a dream world and a reality, and that the sad half of it is the reality, and the other half is kind of the Hollywood, you know, the horrors of Hollywood and the beauty of Hollywood. But I don't know if you'd be willing to do this, but I wanted to ask you what you had in mind as the meaning behind the movie and what your intent was in terms of what you wanted to communicate to the audience.
I love you very much. I always say, in this world, as soon as one finishes a film, people want you to turn it into words and to say things about it. And I believe a film is the thing. The film is the thing. Nothing should be added to it. Nothing should be taken away. You work for a long time to make it a certain way where it feels correct. And so it's a thing that feels correct to me, and one hopes it feels good to others, but you can never be sure. And like I said earlier, in an audience, there's many, many, many interpretations, and each one I say is valid.
Everybody knows meditation's helpful, but it's really hard to do and keep doing. And you seem to have succeeded to teach the hardest of anybody, which is teenagers to meditate. In the most practical way possible, how do we do it? Just because we all know we want to, but it's hard to do and sustain.
I would just answer, then Bobby can answer.
so go on to like 11 or 12.
I think especially in the old days, meditation was seen to be something that took you out of life, or you wanted to recede to a cave, and that it was hard work. The concentration forms of meditation, in my mind, are those that are difficult, and those people probably call transcendental meditation light. But to me, it's meditation profoundly heavy. It's so enjoyable. Transcending, you're diving into bliss, happiness. You get bliss, they say, takes up where happiness leaves off. Bliss can be physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual happiness all at once. You can vibrate in this. It's so beautiful, into bliss. And it come out, you're so, like they say, rejuvenated, blissful, ready to go. It's not hard work, and that's my experience. Sometimes when you're working away, you don't want to stop and go meditate. But the reason you're enjoying the work so much, if my personal experience, is because you've been meditating all this and you get more happiness. So it's always money in the bank to go and do it. And every time you do it, it's enjoyable.
In San Francisco right now, there's now programs, we call it Quiet Time, bringing meditation to the schools in the toughest neighborhoods in the U.S. And Lauren Valisek and the Center for Wellness and Achievement in Education, CWAE, a sister organization with the David Lynch Foundation, they've taught 11,000 public school students to do this. Now, if it was a difficult meditation, if it was hard and made effort, that would never happen. And my experience, because I'm in New York, is that that ability to turn the attention within, it's like a dive. Child is standing by the side of the pool and you say, honey, just stand like that, and then gravity takes over. So there's no effort in this. And it's a very satisfying experience. And if I could spin off on one thing on this, and then what's happened in San Francisco, to me, has fed into something really important for education in the world today, and this is my passion. The University of Chicago Crime Lab, 3 years ago, put out a request for proposals. What can we do to stop the violence in the toughest schools in Chicago? And they sent a team to meet with Laurent and CWE, the schools, Visitation Valley and other schools. What they saw there was so so inspiring, they came back, they gave a first year, 230 organizations submitted proposals. Oh, we can help reduce violence. Crime Lab accepted three. David Lynch Foundation was one. They gave a $300,000 grant. It was so successful. Last year, they increased it to another $1 million. And this year, it has been so successful, they increased it to $2.6 million. So they, And one of the things they were looking at was, how do we reduce arrests in the summer months when the kids aren't in school? And this was a big test, because would kids meditate during the summer months? And if they have an intervention that can reduce arrests among high school kids by 5%, they're thrilled. And the preliminary data coming out of the University of Chicago is that's 10 times higher among the meditating school kids during summer months. So now we're looking to replicate this in New York, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, all over. Because when we can show that a simple tool, we're talking a lot of philosophy here in big pictures, we are. It's the simplest thing. You learn to close your eyes. You can learn, anybody can close their eyes. You don't have to learn to close your eyes. Close your eyes, you learn a simple technique that a 10-year-old child with ADD, who can't close their eyes for a half a minute, learns this. Or I work with a lot of kids on the autism spectrum. They close their eyes, and without any doing, there's this just deep settling down. The body gets this deep rest. The activity, agitated thinking mind, on its own settles down. That heals trauma. That reset. That just the connections in the brain, the traumatized connect, the arousal of the amygdala, and the shutting down of the frontal lobe from trauma switches. And now the frontal lobe comes back online. Executive functioning, the amygdala calms down, cortisol calms down. These kids now, higher graduate, here in San Francisco, Laurent has done, higher graduation rates, closing of the achievement gap, reduced suspensions and expulsions. The work that's been done in San Francisco, in my opinion, is already changing education in America, and now the David Lynch Foundation has provided scholarships for teaching 600,000 kids for free all over the world, and our goal is to increase that to 6 million in the next few years. So really great. Is Laurent out here?
Where's Laurent? Can you stand up, Laurent? That's a great man, Laurent. Fantastic, buddy. Laurent and his team are the people you want to meet to get things going here in San Francisco.
Hi, David. Just a question about you catching the ideas. Like, what are some examples of the bare form of the ideas when they come? Like, is it something more like a feeling, or is it a shape? I guess just some examples of that. And follow on to that is, when you catch the ideas in this state, do you lay any sort of judgment on them while you're in that state, or do you only lay the judgment later when you are out of the state?
It could be, depending on if it's a cinema idea, it would be maybe an example. I'd see a person, and by seeing him, I would know this person, I would sort of know how they talk, and I'd see what they were wearing, and I'd see a room that they'd be in, and a mood in the room, a light, kind of a light. And I could say that sometimes it would come with a sound. It's like, it would be like a little short piece of a film would just appear. And if I fell in love with it, I'd fall in love with it because I liked the feeling of it. And it'd be something that would really get my interest and hold a promise for more. And I don't pass judge. I just would fall in love with that particular idea. I'd write it down. I always say, you've got to write down the idea, and you write it down with words in a way that when you read those words again, the idea will come back in full.
Thank you for these brilliant descriptions you've been giving, both of you, and thanks to City Arts. So, with all this wonderful track record, what is holding back the insurance industry and the government from providing more support in the system?
That's such a beautiful question. Bobby Roth is going to answer it.
I get the feeling we're in a David Lynch film. The big issue with the insurance companies is they have not been wanting to fund prevention because there's no way of knowing are people doing the preventive measure. If you have high blood pressure and then you take an intervention, you'd reduce blood pressure and they say, oh, okay, that's working. Or you give someone a treadmill to prevent a heart attack or to stay in shape, but they don't have a problem, then they don't know if it's being used. That situation is changing dramatically because the healthcare costs are just going through the roof right now. And so they're being forced to look at evidence-based approaches to prevent a lot of these very costly disorders. And so we are in the process of talking with a number of insurance companies because there's so much data now. Particularly right now, the strongest data is in heart health. As far as government goes, the David Lynch Foundation has established, with the generosity of a donor, a office on Capitol Hill. And I spend a lot of my time now in Washington, D.C., teaching members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. So we're working, and there's a lot of interest, particularly in the area of veterans. There's a lot of research that shows this is effective, and so we're looking for developing so that government programs, also SAMHSA, which is involved in substance use disorder. We have a big outreach now using TM for preventing opioid addiction. So there's a lot of different areas. I'm very, very excited about it. It's interesting to be going full circle from 1969 when I was interested in doing some sort of social transformation with politics, and now it's seeing it taking on its own life with meditation. And I don't know how much more time we have, and David Lynch often likes to say Bobby is doing this, and the two people who call me Bobby were my mother and David. David says, oh, Bobby's doing this or that, but the fact of the matter is, almost 13 years ago, this man said yes to starting a foundation, has traveled around the world many times, coming up here, written a book, edited together a documentary, done gazillions of interviews, and just brings his impeccable honesty and integrity to everything he does, including this field of meditation. So it's really, David, you are a great filmmaker and a great man. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Bobby.
And
hi. You talk about diving down to discover the light, and yet your films dive deep down to the dark. Your characters suffer, and they are figuratively and literally monstrous. So, and I think that what makes them so seductive is indeed this... how you have artistically depicted the dark side that exists within us to make evident how seductive it can be. There is an atmosphere, there is a mood and a disposition that's very almost identical to your films, and it exists within us simultaneously as the light that we all wish to achieve. So how do you, where's the balance, where's the interplay between light and dark in this path to enlightenment, freedom? How do you reconcile,
They say there is only light, and where it's dim, it's dark, but really only light is. They say there's consciousness, and where that's low is negativity. And but I say, like many times I go to places, they say, David, if you're so happy and blissful, how come you make these films? And I say, you know, stories have been told throughout time, and stories aren't just one flat line. They have all kinds of highs and lows, conflicts, life and death situations, darkness and light, goodness and evil, all these things throughout time, stories. I say, you don't have to suffer. You can be happy. You have to understand suffering, understand the human condition. You have to get these ideas, but you should have the suffering in the book or on the screen, not in your life. And it's like, also, I'm going to fall in love with certain ideas, and Susie's going to fall in love with different ideas, and it's beautiful to be in love and to create something. And people don't have to go see the films, but if they do, you know, this is what this particular story is about. And this character is more like a monster, but this one here is very sweet and happy, and it's just the way the story unfolded. But you don't have to suffer to show suffering.
There's a Picasso quote where he says that art is a form of magic designed as a mediator between this strange, hostile world and ourselves, a way of seizing the control by giving form to our fears as well as our desires.
Yeah, but I don't set out, you know, personally to do something like, I just get ideas.
Right.
That's it.
Hi. I've been curious about TM for a long time now, and I have when I've asked people how much it is, I've found it prohibitively expensive for me, and I love all the work you're doing for marginalized populations, and that rules, and if I had a bunch of money, then I think I would have tried it by now, but it's sort of just at a price point that's feels a bit scary for me, and so I'm wondering how the price point is arrived at, sort of what that's about, and if there's a future in which it is just a little bit cheaper, and so therefore able for, well, I'm an artist, I'm a working artist, to afford.
There is now a scale. So it's scaled according to the ability to pay. People say, oh, it goes anywhere. If a person makes a lot of money, it's $960. I should tell you that that's a lifetime and part of fee. There's no, and that part of that money also goes to help kids and veterans learn to meditate for free. But it scales all the way down to $300+, and you can pay it over time so that the teacher can live. We want to support the teachers, because you have a teacher for the rest of your life. So there's the intention by working with government, the intention by working with insurance companies or employee assistance programs, or the way we're talking with David Lynch Foundation, is that there's no obstacle for anyone to ever learn to meditate. We want to make sure that everyone can have access. At the same time, it's an educational institution. Salaries have to be paid. You have to pay rent. But we're working very closely on that, and I know here, Brett and Jane Lazareski with the TM organization here and others are working very hard to make that happen.
We should have a starving artist rate for him.
Yeah. You can get a David Lynch Foundation grant.
I'm all for a low rate for you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Hi. Bob. It's Kate from Chicago.
Hi.
I just want to say thank you for your work in Chicago. And like you, my passion also is in education. And I have two questions for you and David relative to education. Can we reach children any earlier than the age of 10?
Yes.
Okay. And can we do that in the schools? Because you know I'm working very hard to get it accessible in the schools in Chicago as much as possible.
So there's the sitting technique where you just looks like this. You know, you close your, you don't have to sit in a particular posture. That starts about the age of 10 or 11, but between the ages of 4 and 5 to 10 or 11, a child can get what they call a word of wisdom, and they get a mantra, and they use it while they're going for a walk or they're drawing, and it has a wonderful resonant effect. And kids learning to do that at an early age, just naturally then when it's time for them to sit at the age of 10 or 11, it's just a very natural process. And one of the things I've noticed these days is more and more families are coming together to learn, because as parents, we're all very concerned about the impact that stress is having on our kids. So much, it's overwhelming, and the statistics are not pretty, and the trajectory that we're on is not sustainable. So starting at that age of 4 or 5, I think is essential. And we just need to do research on it. We haven't done research like we have on everything else.
Please join me in thanking Bob Roth and David Lynn.
Thank you all very much.
I want to say about the book.
Oh,
say about the book that.
Yeah.
You want to, no, it's free. We're donating our money. Yeah. I'll say. Can I say
thank you?
Sorry, go ahead and say it.
So I want to say one last thing. David and I are, if you decide to get a book and we will sign it, 100% of the proceeds that David and I would be getting will go towards teaching here in San Francisco kids and veterans and women who are victims of domestic violence to learn for free. So we are doing that back, giving back here.
Beautiful. Adam, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A pleasure.